This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ إِلَّا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, The evils are gone away from me. Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi is threatening to quit his post if the complicated political situation lingers. A delegation from the UN nuclear agency is heading to the southern Ukraine to inspect a nuclear power plant that is in control of Russian forces. And the United Nations is warning of a possible new violence in Libya, where no progress has been made toward holding elections. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: in Iraq, the Prime Minister is threatening to step down if the ongoing political chaos is not resolved.
And I warn that from now on, if they want to continue to stir up chaos, conflict, discord and strife, and not listen to the voice of reason, I will take my moral and patriotic steps by announcing the vacancy of the position of Prime Minister at the appropriate time, according to Article 81 of the Iraqi Constitution, and hold them accountable before the Iraqis and before history.
Mustafa al-Kadhimi also said a commission of inquiry will be formed to probe into the origin of the weapons used in the recent deadly clashes in the capital, Baghdad. Chaos broke out on Monday after cleric Muqtada al-Sadr said he was quitting politics in response to a prolonged political deadlock in the country. He criticized other political leaders for not heeding his calls for reform. Saad supporters broke into the Green Zone and stormed the presidential palace. The unrest prompted a nationwide curfew and the closure of government organizations. The ensuing clashes resulted in nearly 30 deaths and left hundreds of people wounded. Later on Tuesday, the situation calmed down after Saad called on his supporters to withdraw from the streets. A UN atomic watchdog team is on its way to Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear power plant amid growing concerns over a leakage of radioactive substances. The delegation that is headed by the International Atomic Energy Agency's chief, Rafael Grossi, is set to inspect the Russian-controlled plant. Moscow and Kiev have been blaming one another for shelling the facility. Just days ago, Ukraine's president said Europe was one step away from a radiation disaster when the plant was briefly disconnected from the power grid. However, Russians say the radiation levels are normal and the situation there is under control. The plant has been in Russian hands since March. It is, however, being operated by Ukrainian staff. Russia says it is again cutting off gas supplies to Germany through the Nord Stream 1 pipeline amid an energy standoff with the West. Russian energy giant Gazprom is citing maintenance issues for slashing the flow. The corporation says a three-day work is necessary at one of the compressor stations. But Germany is reacting to Russia's new interruption skeptically, saying the move is technically incomprehensible. The Federal Network Agency says this is likely a political decision and just a pretext by Moscow to wield energy supplies as a threat. Germany is heavily dependent on Russian gas. The country is already grappling with soaring energy prices and record high inflation. Back in July, Russia cut off gas to Germany for 10 days. Moscow argues that the Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine are impeding its normal maintenance and repair work and therefore cause disruptions to the flow. Italy has had the lowest in the EU, the growth in average salary, for over 30 years. This as the country is grappling with skyrocketing levels of inflation and energy costs. Max Civili reports from Rome.
Italy is coming last among all EU countries when it comes to average salary growth, according to a new study released by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, also known as OECD. The average gross salary in 2021, as stated by the OECD, was an upward estimate of 29,700 euros, which is practically the same amount of earnings recorded in 1991. Italy is also one of a handful of countries not covered in a new EU minimum wage directive to guarantee decent living standards for workers.
Many are struggling to make ends meet, living on starvation wages, particularly those with kids. Our government is dreadful. We must replace our politicians.
I'm paid low wages in the order of 5-6 euros per hour. I worked in the hospitality sector and I work long hours, but I don't make much at the end of the month. Thank goodness I'm still living with my parents.
Italy is crippled by high inflation and skyrocketing energy costs. Inflation in the country reached 8% in June, the highest spike since 1976, with severe consequences on the cost of living.
The considerable spike of the inflation rate triggered by the rising cost of energy is now affecting food prices and weighing very much on families and businesses. Let me say the situation is extremely complex in Italy and in Europe.
Energy prices have risen to historic highs in Italy as wholesale gas prices have surged to skyrocketing levels. Businesses complain energy bills have gone up 10 times compared to last year, and in this scenario, thousands of companies risk going bankrupt in the coming months.
Following the collapse of the Mario Draghi government in July, Italian voters will return to the polls on September 25 amid growing public discontent and profound distrust in politics. According to the latest polls, at least 16 million Italians, or 35% of total electors, are likely to skip the vote. Most of them believe voting is useless. Max Civili, Rome.
The United Nations is warning that the ongoing political limbo in Libya has the potential to endanger security not only in the capital, Tripoli, but also countrywide.
I am deeply concerned that the ongoing stalemate and continued delays in implementing the electoral process pose a growing threat to security in and around Tripoli, and potentially to all Libyans.
Undersecretary General Rosemary DiCarlo says no progress has been made on building a consensus on a constitutional framework for the elections. A fresh spate of violence erupted last week in Tripoli with heavy gunfire and shelling, leaving 32 people dead. The two rival prime ministers were quick to blame the violence on each other, a failure to hold long-awaited elections as escalated tensions to a new level. There are currently two rival administrations in Libya, one in the west and the other in the east. Incumbent Prime Minister Abdelhamid Zebeiba is refusing to step down, while Fathi Bashagha, who was appointed prime minister by the parliament in the east, has been seeking to capture Tripoli. Israel's Supreme Court has once again refused to release Palestinian hunger-striking detainee Khalil Awada despite his serious health condition and growing calls for his release. Awada's lawyer said the court claims it is not an appeal body against the decision made on August 21st to freeze the Palestinian inmates' so-called administrative detention. This came despite growing calls for the release of Awada, who is in critical health condition. He has been on an open-ended hunger strike for 171 days in protest at his detention without charge or trial. The European Union delegation to Palestine has expressed shock at images of Awada calling for his release. Awada said in a message that his weak body represents the real face of the Israeli occupation. Over 680 Palestinians are being held by Israel without charge or trial. Moving on, Mikhail Gorbachev, the first and last president of the Soviet Union, has died at the age of 91. According to Russian media, Gorbachev died on Tuesday evening in Moscow after a serious illness. Gorbachev ruled the Soviet Union from 1985 until its collapse in 1991. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1990 for his role in bringing an end to the Cold War. President Vladimir Putin has expressed his deep condolences on his death. World leaders have also paid tribute to him. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has sent a message praising Gorbachev as a one-of-a-kind statesman who changed the course of history. The US dollar has remained the world's top currency when it comes to trade, but its standing is increasingly coming under threat. Countries like Iran, China, and Russia are giving it a run for the money, challenging the standing of the US dollar to be the world's top currency. Iran's central bank has announced that Iran and Russia will plan to de-dollarize several sectors in their commercial relations in line with their previous moves.
Iran's central bank says Tehran and Moscow have officially started doing business in their national currencies, adding both countries are considering de-dollarizing other parts of their economic ties. Tehran and Moscow had long been seeking to create a mechanism to replace the US dollar with their national currencies, rial and ruble, as part of a joint de-dollarization agenda, regardless of the tough economic sanctions in place against the two nations. Iran and Russia have both been subjected to tough economic sanctions by Western countries and are determined to deepen their economic cooperation, adding that there are great capacities for increasing the volume of bilateral trade. Several officials in Tehran and Moscow have repeatedly accused the United States of using the dollar as an instrument to wage economic and political war. China is another economic and political power that has opted to move toward de-dollarization. In fact, Iran, Russia, and China have discussed the de-dollarization of their trade for decades and have considered launching an alternative for the worldwide interbank financial telecommunication global network, or SWIFT. Following the breakout of the Russia-Ukraine conflict early this year, U.S.-led Western governments imposed several rounds of financial sanctions on Moscow, including freezing its foreign exchange reserves. The thought that the U.S. may move to confiscate one's assets in case they refuse to accept what Washington dictates has caused more countries to consider diversifying their reserve assets away from U.S. dollar. Consequently, many countries have turned away from European democracies and Washington. Regardless of who wins the Ukraine war, the United States and its allies will be the strategic losers. Russia will probably build closer relations with China and other countries on the Eurasian continent, including India, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the Persian Gulf Arab countries.
We are seeing a deepening of ties unlike any other time that we've seen before. And ultimately what this means is that the relationship between Russia and China is no longer being governed by the same economic rules that had governed it prior to this year. That is that Russian rubles are being traded. They're no longer doing business in dollars. And ultimately that is hurting the United States, and it's going to change the dollar's hegemony.
In recent years, with the increased weaponization of the dollar and Washington's use of the dollar to sanction the so-called unruly countries in America's eyes, many countries in the world have awakened and begun to experiment trading in their own national currencies.
Finally, August 30th marks the one-year anniversary since the last American forces left Afghanistan, potentially ending the longest war and occupation in U.S. history. The pretext for its invasion of Afghanistan was the so-called War on Terror following the 9/11 attacks in the United States. However, despite two decades of military presence, the U.S. has not only failed to eradicate terrorism but brought bloodshed and chaos to Afghanistan as a whole. We have a report on this.
U.S. first invaded Afghanistan. The reason Washington wanted to remove the Taliban from power, who had given refuge to alleged 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden. After 2 months of incessant bombardment, the U.S. and its allied forces overturned the Taliban rule and replaced it with a cabinet filled with Western-educated Afghan individuals. But the U.S. finally realized that the Taliban are the force to reckon with. After months of negotiations, Washington bowed to the Taliban's demands and agreed to end its presence there. It was the mid-August in 2021 when Washington started hasty withdrawal and the Taliban started taking over the war-ravaged nation. Those Afghan officials, once at the helm, were nowhere, nor had tens of thousands of troops the U.S. trained to establish security in the country. But the occasion was joyous for many Afghans who believed they were at least free from the occupation.
I am very happy that I have come along with my friends to celebrate independence and the defeat of the Americans and their slaves. All the friends are here, and we all are happy that we are celebrating our independence standing in front of the U.S. Embassy. I'm so happy that I can't even express myself correctly.
U.S. Republican lawmakers blamed President Joe Biden for what they called humiliating exit from Afghanistan. That despite a deal with the Taliban inked with Biden's predecessor, who himself was a Republican. Other than blame game, none actually suggested a solution for how the U.S. could have properly ended a feudal war that cost American taxpayers more than $2.3 trillion. Critics, however, say the U.S. must have not invaded Afghanistan in the first place, a view Biden seemingly expressed himself when asked about the pullout.
Can Al-Qaeda come back? Yeah, but guess what? It's already back other places. What's the strategy? Every place where Al-Qaeda is, we're going to invade and have troops stay there? Come on.
No matter what, Afghanistan will be a nightmare, not only for Americans, but those who remain there with a devastating aftermath of the war. Violent attacks and explosions are still daily occurrences, and the country is on the verge of collapse amid unprecedented poverty it has not seen before.
If the economy is not able to recover and grow meaningfully and sustainably, then the Afghan people will face repeated humanitarian crises, potentially spurring mass migration and making conditions ripe for radicalization and renewed armed conflict.
Almost 80% of the national budget for Afghanistan prior to the Taliban takeover came from the international community. The crisis has multiplied since the U.S. and some of its allies have frozen billions of dollars in Afghan assets despite calls by humanitarian organizations to release those funds. It seems the U.S. shows no regard for Afghans dying from hunger. More than 70,000 civilians are estimated to have died and millions more displaced as a direct result of the war. That number continues to grow as the U.S. has not stopped attacking the country. In its most recent attack last month, the U.S. struck Kabul with several drones to allegedly kill an Al-Qaeda leader. A historic failure in Afghanistan and widespread opposition at home and abroad seem to not have taught the U.S. leadership a lesson. Washington is still maintaining strong military presence overseas and is not holding back from embarking on new conflicts in one or other region.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Many thanks for joining us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting. And everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
The deadly Israeli wars on Gaza are made possible not only by Western weapons and political support, but through an endless stream of media misinformation and misrepresentation, says Ramzi Barut, journalist, in an article published under the heading Deliberate Misrepresentation. Western media bias makes Zionist regime war on Palestinians possible. Here's more. While U.S. and Western mainstream and corporate media remain biased in favor of the Zionist regime, they often behave as if they are a third neutral party. This is simply not the case. Take the New York Times coverage of the Zionist regime's latest war on Gaza as an example. Its article on August 6 is Israel-Gaza fighting flares for a second day. It's a typical mainstream Western reporting on the Zionist regime and Palestine, but with a distinct NYT flavor. For the uninformed reader, the article succeeds in finding a balanced language between two equal sides. This misleading moral equivalence is one of the biggest intellectual blind spots for Western journalists. If they do not outwardly champion the Zionist regime's discourse on security and right to defend itself, they create false parallels between Palestinians and Israelis as if a military occupier and an occupied nation have comparable rights and responsibilities. For
for New York Times and all mainstream Western media, there is no question regarding who the good guys and the bad guys are in that bloody fight. Palestinians, in their view, always have been the West bad guys. Per the logic of their media coverage, the Zionist regime does not launch unprovoked wars on Palestinians and is not an unrepentant military occupier or a racist apartheid regime. This language can only be used by marginal, radical, and leftist media, never the mainstream. The brief introduction of the NYT article spoke about the rising death toll, but did not initially mention that 20 killed Palestinians include children, emphasizing instead that Israeli regime attacks have killed a leader. When the 6 children killed by the Zionist regime are revealed in the second paragraph, the article immediately and without starting a new sentence clarifies that Israel said some civilian deaths were the result of militants stashing weapons in residential areas and that others were killed by misfired Palestinian rockets. On August 16th, the Zionist regime military finally admitted that it was behind the strikes that killed the 5 young Palestinian boys of Jabalia. Whether the NYT reported on that or not matters little. The damage has been done, and that was the Zionist regime's plan from the start. The title of the BBC story of August 16th, Gaza's Children Are Used to the Death and Bombing, does not immediately name those responsible for the death and bombing. Even the Zionist regime military spokesman, as we will discover later, would agree to such a statement, though they will always lay the blame squarely on the Palestinians. When the story finally reveals that a little girl, Layan, was killed in an Israeli regime strike, the language was carefully crafted to lessen the blame on her, Israeli regime murderers. The girl, we are told, was on her way to the beach with her family when their tuk-tuk passed by a military camp run by the group Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which at the exact moment was targeted by Israeli fire. The author says nothing of how she reached the conclusion that the family was not the target. One can easily glean from the story that the Zionist regime intention was not to kill Layan, and logically, none of the 17 other children murdered during the three-day war on Gaza. Besides, the Zionist regime has, according to the BBC, tried to save the little girl. Alas, a week of treatment and an Israeli hospital couldn't save her life. Though the Zionist regime politicians have spoken blatantly about killing Palestinian children, and in the case of former Israeli regime so-called Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked, the Palestinian mothers who give birth to little snakes, the BBC report and other reports on the latest war have failed to mention this. Instead, it quoted Israeli regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid, who reportedly said that the death of innocent civilians, especially children, is heartbreaking. Incidentally, Lapid ordered the latest war on Gaza, which killed a total of 49 Palestinians. Even a human interest story about a murdered Palestinian child somehow avoided the language that could fault the fabricated regime of Israel for the gruesome killing of a little girl. Furthermore, the BBC also labored to present the Zionist regime in a positive light, resorting to quote the occupation army's statement that it was devastated by Layan's death and that of any civilians. The New York Times and BBC have been selected here not because they are the worst examples of Western media bias, but because they are often cited as liberal, if not progressive media. The reporting, however, represents an ongoing crisis in Western journalism, especially relating to Palestine. Books have been written about this subject. Civil society organizations were formed to hold Western media accountable, and numerous editorial board meetings were organized to put some pressure on Western editors to no avail. Desperate by the unchanging pro-Israel narratives in Western media, some pro-Palestine human rights advocates often argue that there are greater margins within Israeli regime's own mainstream media than in the U.S., for example. This, too, is inaccurate. The misnomer of the supposedly more balanced Israeli regime media is a direct outcome of the failure to influence Western media coverage on Palestine and the Zionist regime. The erroneous notion is often buoyed by the fact that an Israeli newspaper like Haaretz gives marginal spaces to critical voices, like those of Israeli journalist Gideon Levy and Amira Haas. Israeli regime propaganda, one of the most sophisticated in the world, however, can hardly be balanced by occasional columns written by a few dissenting journalists. Additionally, Haaretz is often cited as an example of relatively fair journalism simply because the alternatives, including the Times of Israel, the Jerusalem Post, and other right-wing Israeli media, are exemplary in their callousness, biased language, and misconstruing of facts. The pro-Israel prejudices in Western media often spill over to Palestine sympathetic media throughout the West Asia region and the rest of the world, especially those reporting on the news in English and French. Since many newspapers and online platforms utilize Western news agencies, they often inadvertently adopt the same language used in Western news sources, thus depicting Palestinian resistors or fighters as militants, the Israeli regime occupation army as Israeli forces, and Israeli war on Gaza as flare-ups of violence. In its totality, this language misinterprets the Palestinian struggle for freedom as random acts of violence within a protracted conflict where innocent civilians like Layan are caught in the crossfire. The deadly Zionist regime wars on Gaza are made possible not only by Western weapons and political support, but through an endless stream of media misinformation and misrepresentation. Though the fabricated regime of Israel has killed thousands of Palestinian civilians in recent years, Western media remains as committed to defending the Zionist regime as if nothing has changed.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. haven of peace for the Shia Muslims. Here is a neighborhood of Sayyida Zainab, an area where once did not have enough room even for its original residents. But today, it is a haven of peace for the Shia Muslims. They live under the auspices of a woman who suffered more than any other. That's why she is called the Mother of Sorrows. She is a mother figure to all Shia Muslims. Her shrine gives shelter from the heavy fire of the Takfiris.
My name is Hussein Faraj Talib. I live in Damascus. I'm studying at Lady Ruqayya Seminary. We have always been here in this neighborhood in all occasions, ceremonies, and rituals. I used to live in the neighborhoods of Al-Madina. Before the Syrian crisis, there was a calm, lovely, and friendly atmosphere in the neighborhood. We used to come from Damascus to Sayyida Zainab or go on a pilgrimage to the shrine of Lady Ruqayya. It was a calm atmosphere day and night. We came out in the morning or at noon. It didn't make any difference when to go out. It was secure all the time. The public transportation was also available. My friend Hafez and I play in teams. Each of us plays in different teams, but it makes no difference which team wins. It doesn't matter whether the team is for teenagers or adults. Stop filming. I'm camera shy. People gathered in large groups. All of them were refugees. They had fled from different neighborhoods, including Al-Kabun, Hersana, Duma, Damascus, Dar'a, Aleppo, and Al-Zahra. They gathered here in this neighborhood next to the daughter of Imam Ali, the first Imam of Shias. The number of children increased rapidly. We had to do something.
We have left our houses because of the insurgent groups around us. They were everywhere in the neighborhood. It was impossible for us to stay even for a minute at our homes. I miss my home and friends, but I cannot do anything. We cannot go back home. It is said that one must hope for the best if they want things to go well. They hit us with rocket-propelled grenades. The armed terrorists broke into our house and occupied it. They hit our house with rocket-propelled grenades and ruined the apartment. However, thank God, we could collect our belongings and take them with us. Others could not.
During the Battle of the Trench, which began in 627, Muslims achieved a victory over the Quraysh and Jewish tribes. So, how could they achieve such a victory? They supported the Prophet and sacrificed their lives.
This is the Vilaya Association. These women listen to religious lessons to boost their morale. They don't know that their teacher, who talks about patience in hard time, has lost her young son, Ahmed Ali, 2 days ago. There is sorrow behind her smiles, just like Lady Zainab. She talks about patience while she is in mourning.
It was a doomsday scene, streets and people. It was dreadful. I prayed, "Oh God, help this dreadful situation get better." We were standing in the street. There was no bread, there was no food, children were crying, they had nothing to eat. My sons took up arms and got back home in order to protect it. If they had gone to a strange neighborhood, terrorists would have penetrated Saida Zainab. They said, "Dear mother, we will stand against them. We will defend to see what our destiny will be. We have to create a buffer zone between people and terrorists before they approach the holy shrine of Lady Zainab." We stayed and suffered a lot. Children were crying until my son took us to this hotel we live in right now.
At the beginning of the crisis, we, the youth of the neighborhood, took up arms and got military training. We set up checkpoints in order to protect our families, the neighborhood, and the holy shrine of Lady Zainab. We tried to prevent Takfiri terrorists from approaching the shrine.
Currently, we do not see each other. In fact, we call each other once a month or two. How are you, mother? Are you okay? Thank God I can hear your voice. I do not see him or even his children. I have not seen my son who lives in Gharbe since the new year.
Martyr Ahmed Ali's mother is busy with teaching in the Valaya Association. She is content that her son was martyred for Lady Zainab. She has sent her other son, Hadi, to the battle to take Ahmed Ali's place and to show her unwavering faith.
I am Hadi. I am a soldier in the infantry battalions of Sayyida Zainab. I am a sniper. I am among back forces of the infantries. These days, jihad is the day's subject. We love jihad. Before the crisis, this place was so populated. People lived here. Children played soccer in alleys. Laborers worked here. There was a grocery store here. There was a supermarket next to it. People lived their normal lives. Since the armed groups occupied this building, people have been displaced. Nobody stayed at home. They made them all escape. This street is under our control. There is no danger. That street was occupied by the armed groups. There were snipers there, so people could not move in this street. If children came out of their homes, the snipers would shoot them.
There is nothing in Hadi's face to hint that he has buried his brother only 2 days ago.
May anybody be still hiding in these buildings?
No, no way. We conducted cleanup operations through the whole area. Nearly 300 soldiers moved in lines and cleaned the area from Takfiris. This crisis is not for freedom or reform. In the beginning, we were not many. We were disorganized too. We never imagined this. We arrested the armed people next to the holy shrine of Lady Zainab. We also discovered car bombs there.
After the crisis, the situation changed a little. We brought order back and settled down in Sayyida Zainab. We could not get out of the neighborhood. We were under siege. Later on, the situation got better.
Thank God the situation got better. The farthest checkpoints were from 150 to 200 meters away. The terrorists could penetrate the holy shrine from six or seven entrances. At first, they wrote on the wall of the shrine that Bashar al-Assad was a goner. But God helped us, the youth, to sacrifice our lives to set up the checkpoints at a farther distance from the shrine. We managed to force them back as far as 10 to 12 kilometers.
Thank you.
I am Sharaf al-Din, a military commander in Imam Hussein Brigade. This brigade defends all the sacred places throughout Syria, and not only Sayyida Zainab. Of course, we were in Zainabia neighborhood, the airport road, and Al-Hajira region. Tomorrow we will move to Daria and the holy shrine of Lady Sakina. If God helps us, we have a plan to carry out an operation here. This is a map of Ghouta Ghariba. This is Daria, and this one is Mazima. Some parts of Daria and Mazima are under the control of the terrorists. They are tired of being there. They will surrender. We had a simple life. I was a bricklayer. We had a good life with our Sunni brothers. There was no enmity between us.
We were forced to leave our homes. Each of us had a job. They said that the Shia Muslims wanted to kill the Sunni Muslims and vice versa. They frightened people, so they left their homes and fled. We stayed here for our faith and beliefs, because it is for our existence.
They claim that it was a conflict between the Shia and Sunni Muslims, but there was no difference between the two. They wanted to take the whole country. They wanted to destroy the concept of true Islam.
Here in Syria, we consider the Sunni Muslims as our brothers and sisters. They are respected. We say prayers in their mosques. Our scholars tell us to say prayers behind their imams. There were no disagreements between us. But these Wahhabi takfiris, who are the followers of Ibn Baz and Ibn Taymiyyah and call themselves the Al-Nusra Front, are not our friends, and we do not respect them.
If you don't know the meaning of resistance, you think that there is no difference between 1 meter and 1 kilometer. But if you know what resistance is, and that loving your homeland is part of your faith, you will sacrifice yourself for every inch of your land. Sharaf al-Din is happy because he managed to make the area around the holy shrine of Lady Zainab with the help of the army and people. Now it is secure from 12 kilometers away. Its value can be recognized by the people who know Lady Zainab and who understands Lady Zainab.
We promised Lady Zainab, O Lady, if we know that we are killed, cut into pieces and burned, if we know that our bodies are melted into the air, we will get alive again and get back. We will be killed again, cut into pieces again and melted into the air again. Then we will get alive again. This will happen not 1,000 times, but 10,000 times. We will not leave you alone.
The aim of the Wahhabis is to destroy this holy shrine. They want to make people forget pilgrimage. They intend to make people forget standing in front of the holy shrine. This is their religion, to destroy these rituals.
She boosts the Shia Muslims' morale with all her sorrows. Lady Zainab is the mother of Syria. However, she suffered in the Levant more than any other place. Although she grieved more in the Levant than in Karbala, she is a mother figure to all the people living here. Not only the Shia, but all Muslims. She is the mother of those who are seeking peace.
There was divine providence in the crisis that swept Syria. We fought against a lot of oppression. It was a test. Whatever it was, the future would be better. I think Syria will have a brilliant future. These were the houses of poor people. God bless you. Where is your home?
This is my home, my son.
This one?
Yes.
What happened? Is it all ruined?
I do not know.
Is this the first time you've come back home? When did you leave your home?
It was nearly 5 months ago.
And this is the first time you've come back home after 5 months, isn't it?
Yes, not this year, but last year. Don't you see I'm weeping? I'm still paying off the mortgage.
So, enter your home. See what happened there. They said that it was a war between the Shia and Sunni Muslims.
No, in my opinion, there is no difference between the Shia and Sunni Muslims.
Did you say that you wanted to send your children to war? Some people think that just the Alawites help the army and the Sunni Muslims do not help it.
No. We are all with the army. I am the first who is for the army. If they allow me, I will join the army. I don't know how to shoot, but I will do anything. Let me tell you, my son, my sons are for our homeland. I will die with glory for my country in Bashar, or my sons will fight and get killed. Then I will be called the mother of martyrs. Otherwise, I will die like a dog and no one will know where my body is. No, I do not want this. I have worked for this house for 25 years. This is not a war between the Shia and Sunni Muslims. This is not a sectarian war.
Returning home is not possible if the Muslims don't resist. Those who sacrificed their lives for saving the people were impatient to see this scene.
Even my brother contacted me and told me to go to his home. I said to him, why? We are living here. There is no news. We are living and working together. We have a sweet life. It wouldn't be better. I have traveled to Lebanon. I have grown up in Lebanon. My father's home is in Beirut. I even went to Saudi Arabia. Nowhere is like Syria, where people are living together in peace. God bless our great leader, Hafez al-Assad. He took an approach that guaranteed the rights of all Syrian ethnic groups.
Sharaf ad-Din also saw his family. The tears he's shedding for his martyred friends are behind his smiles, behind the kisses on his son's cheeks. Although his friends are not alive, they stand more firmly than before. They are looking at Sharaf ad-Din and other Muslims' resistance. They know that the resistance will continue.
We were annoyed in Syria. We suffered a lot of oppression that nobody else had faced. This scar will not heal in one day. Our faith is more important than anything else. I wish I would be a martyr when defending Lady Zainab and my country, Syria, which is a home to all kinds of people. Do not think that we give up.
Death is for all. God says, and we will surely test you with something of fear and hunger and a loss of wealth and lives and fruits, but give good tidings to the patient. We see this God's blessing that we resisted. We are patient and grateful. These are no troubles. Trouble means that God brings problems for us and we are not patient. If we become patient, we will receive the reward.
Children always chant, "We answer to your invitation, Lady Zainab." This raises the morale of people, women, and even soldiers. When soldiers see that these children say, "We answer to your invitation, Lady Zainab," they know that if they are martyred, people will follow their path.
in the limelight.
Federal data published recently shows that non-financial corporate profits in the U.S. surged on an all-time record of $2 trillion in the second quarter of 2022 as companies continued jacking up prices, pushing inflation to a 40-year high to the detriment of workers and consumers. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. corporate profits surge to an all-time high of $2 trillion. Here's more. Federal data published recently shows that non-financial corporate profits in the United States surged to an all-time record of $2 trillion in the second quarter of 2022 as companies continued jacking up prices, pushing inflation to a 40-year high to the detriment of workers and consumers. According to figures released by the Commerce Department's Bureau of Economic Analysis, BEA, corporate profit margins over the past 3 months were the widest they have been since 1950s, as ongoing price hikes pat the bottom lines of large businesses and eat into the paychecks of employees. We can argue until the cows come home about the cause of inflation, Chris Becker, senior economist at the Groundwork Collaborative, wrote in response to the new data, adding, "But we can't lose sight of the basic moral point that it is outrageous that corporations are seeing skyrocketing profits while purchasing power for so many American households is declining." Bloomberg noted recently that with household budgets squeezed by the rising cost of living, some firms have been able to offset any slip in demand by charging more to the customers they have retained. Across the economy, adjusted pre-tax corporate profits increased 6.1% in the April to June period from the prior quarter, the fastest pace in a year, after falling 2.2% in the first 3 months of the year. The outlet continued, profits are up 8.1% from a year earlier. Rakin Mabut, the Groundwork Collaborative chief economist, said in a statement that the astronomical corporate profits confirm what corporate executives have been telling us on earnings calls over and over again. They are making a lot of money by charging people more, and they don't plan on bringing prices down anytime soon. Corporate profiteering continues in full force, and all of us are paying the price, Mabut added. This data should be a wake-up call for policymakers. Mega corporations are a key driver of high prices in the U.S., and we need to bold actions to rein them in. The BEA numbers came after oil companies, food giants, and other major businesses reported record-shattering profits in the second quarter of this year as they take advantage of the crisis in Eastern Europe, the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, and supply chain disruptions to drive up prices. According to 1% analysis, the profits of 8 top oil companies, including Chevron, ExxonMobil, and Shell, are up 235% compared to last year. The glaringly obvious takeaway from this new data is that market power is a key driver of rising prices, said Sarah Miller, executive director of the American Economic Liberties Project, adding, Policymakers need to use this new information, which confirms what working families across the U.S. know all too well, to attack concentrated corporate power immediately and aggressively across the board. That means levying excess profit taxes, ensuring big penalties for price fixing, and resourcing enforcement agencies to prosecute price gouging and other forms of corporate abuse, Miller added. And it means banning large mergers, stock buybacks, and payoffs for layoffs to help build durable market power for working people and consumers and level the playing field for small businesses and entrepreneurs. The newly enacted Inflation Reduction Act includes a corporate minimum tax.